Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off Broadway, and beyond. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to Susan Laurie Parks and Oscar Eustace. Parks is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, whose plays include Top Dog Underdog, Venus, The Red Letter Plays, and Father Comes Home from the Wars, Parts 1, 2, and 3. And Eustace is the artistic director at Off-Broadway's Public Theater, where everything from Hair to Hamilton got their start. The Public is also where Parks' latest play, White Noise, is now running in a production directed by Eustace. They're both here with me to talk about the play and all the hot buttons it pushes: race, art, slavery, and, of course, bowling.
Hi, Susan Laurie and Oscar. Thanks for joining me.
Pleasure, Gordon. Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
I wanted to start by talking about, what is clearly the sort of most urgent issue addressed in the play, and that is, of course, bowling. For people who have not seen the play yet, there's this fairly extraordinary setup where they're taking actual balls and they're bowling them at the audience underneath us. I guess depending on where you're sitting, but where I was sitting, they were underneath us, apparently it works like a bowling, like an actual bowling alley, and there are these little gutters that then carry them back to the performers to use. And is that theatrical magic, or did that actually happen? Is it an actual working kind of bowling lane?
No, actually, we have a whole group of very small underprivileged children who are called pin boys who live under the stage.
Right. And well, it's thematically appropriate, I think, is that.
In exchange for free tickets to all the public
shows. To all the public shows, which is not nothing, let's be honest.
That's pretty great. They don't have to stand in line for Shakespeare in the park. They can just work. No, that's not true.
No, we do not do that.
Of course not.
We would not do that.
News.
Any theater director who would try to do that.
Exactly.
The bowling is the essential physical activity of the play.
Yeah.
It was from the moment that Susan Laurie started conceiving it. The bowling, of course, the climax of the first act and the second act take place in a bowling alley.
Yep.
And the thing I was sure of when we started working on it, that the actors needed to be bowling straight at the audience, that there was no other relationship that would dramatically make sense. And fortunately, the genius designer Clint Ramos and our brilliant production team with the Public figured out how to make that magic happen.
Does it ever not work? Like, do the bowling balls always get to the right place?
No. The bowling balls sometimes get to the wrong place. Right. They now, in preview, they got to the wrong place with greater frequency.
Sure.
And more surprising results.
Yes.
Now that we are through the preview period, it is very rare that a bowling ball ends up in the wrong place.
Although once I was backstage, maybe last week, you read about it in the report. I was backstage and just right in the little hallway, and a bowling ball came shooting into the hallway. And we were all like, what the fuck, right? And everybody, Jeremy and the whole team were on there. Is this bad? Anyway, they were
you
all
should not be revealing our dirty bowling laundry on Gordon's podcast.
But we watched the replay, and Tommy had actually kicked the ball off the stage.
Oh wow.
So there was because the scene was so intense at the end that some shit was going down, and Tommy Sadowski, Ralph, kicked the ball off the stage, and that was an intense moment.
Here's a question. How good of a bowler do the four cast members, including Thomas Sadowski and David Diggs, this is a great cast, and Zoe Winters and Sheree, help me with her last name, Irving, thank you. Mm-hmm. Were there bowling rehearsals, and how extensive were they?
David took bowling lessons.
Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, we actually forced David to take bowling lessons.
Mm-hmm. Because he was so bad?
The fact is that his character Leo is so good, and we wanted to produce him.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
And we all went bowling as a cast, which was really exciting.
Really fun.
And who is the best bowler?
Sheree.
Sheree is the best bowler.
Okay.
Jeremy, our assistant stage manager, is brilliant.
Fucking brilliant. Amazing. Down. He's so good.
He's our ringer. But what we soon realized after spending some time with bowling lessons is because nobody in the play actually has to knock pins down, that's not what they're doing. What they're doing is actually throwing the ball. That we realized that the look and confidence with which they threw was way more important than their ability to actually a real bowling alley. Right. So we began to work in a slightly different way.
Right. So all joking aside, bowling, as you alluded to, Oscar, is very important to this play. Right. And it is very Susan, let me tell us a little bit about kind of where bowling came from and how it opens up what the rest of the play is about.
Yeah, I mean, where bowling came from for me.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why it exists, period. But yeah.
I know, why bowling? You know, I mean, I used to watch my parents bowl. My dad was in the service, and we traveled around a lot. And when I was growing up, wherever you moved, there was always a bowling alley. And bowling, while there are some in the world, of course, highly skilled bowlers, my experience with bowling is, for my parents, is that you didn't have to be great to participate. So they would go out in the evenings and meet, they could be social right when they arrived in town, which was lovely. And they would go bowling, and I would watch them take their bowling balls and happily go and join a new group of friends, new friends.
Right.
And sometimes I would go with them and just sit in the back and just watch them bowl because it was cool to watch. I just enjoyed it's repetitive, you could say violent without being really violent because you're basically hurling a ball at some things and trying to knock them down,
But then why for you was it an integral part of this play as it was coming together for you?
It's played all over the world. It seems because there is a bowling alley in the basement. There's a bowling alley in the basement of the White House, maybe right by the fallout shelter. I don't know exactly where it is. But it seems just an integral part of American, literally, it's an integral part of the American subculture. It really is. Uh-huh. And I was joking with David the other day, it's probably part of the Underground Railroad is a bowling alley. it just was in my guts for a long time.
And right. Yeah.
So I just put it in the play.
And then as the talk a little bit more about the play itself and kind of where it came from and kind of how the idea came to you and when you started to think about it as a play and as these group of characters
these
in this story.
Of friends, It started, by now we've like told the stories, Oscar and I, over and over to each other.
Yeah.
So I was in the very theater that where it's playing in now, the Osbacher Theater at the Public Theater. And in 2014, there was a play, Father Comes Home from the Wars, March right. 1, 2, and 3,
yeah.
that I'd written. And there was a part, a moment in that play where the lead character, Hero, who is an enslaved person, play takes place in 1860. Man. And he is imagining the future, what it will be like to walk down the street as a free man, and if he is approached by law enforcement individuals. And they say, who do you belong to? And he says, I belong to myself. Will they leave him alone? Will that be, you know, who owns right. you? I own myself.
Right.
Will they leave him be? And his friend, he's asking his friend, and his friend Smith says, you know, I don't know. And so I watched that scene over and over and over. And I thought, I have to write a play about the future, which is now.
Right.
And it started from there, basically. Right. And that moment of that hands up, don't shoot moment basically happens in this play at the same spot on the stage.
Oh, yeah.
So it's very exciting for me, just being a dweeb like that.
And that is for people who haven't seen it, that is sort of the inciting event of the play. It is a thing that happens to David Diggs' character and inspires the...
Right. The action
of the
And
did you have a sense of what the broader where it would go from there? Like, did you have a sense of this play is going to be this as you started out on it? And if so, how did that change as it developed?
I'm looking at Oscar for like I don't know. I started in this play is going to be that. No, I didn't. Yeah. I just knew it was going to be contemporary. It was going to involve some people. And they were going to go through some shit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of all I knew. And then, and then, can we talk about the names now?
Yeah, please.
And then,
yeah,
and then I started telling myself a dumb joke. And this is what I now know, probably by working on this play. Because every time we work on a new thing, I think we learn about, we can look back at our old works with greater clarity, maybe. Yeah. I mean, maybe not, but... For me, it happened this time around, where I was telling we were at Yale, right? We were at Yale doing something.
Wyndham Campbell.
The Wyndham. Yeah, we were there, and you had directed
the monologue from Leo's monologue from the opening of White Noise, and the little piece from Top Dog.
Right, and then we were in a Q&A with the audience.
That's right.
And I just started running my mouth. Right.
That's right. You did. My favorite thing.
Blah 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 blah. It's like Ralph at one of his club meetings. Blah 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 blah. But I was telling the audience like where the names of the characters came from, and I said, you know, so it's Leo, Dawn, Misha, and Ralph. Those are the names of our four characters. And I said, anybody know the Ninja Turtles? Leonardo, Donatello, Michelangelo, Raphael. And right, so it's like a dumb joke. It makes you laugh.
Yeah.
And so what I realized, oh shit. That's what I do when I write. I tell myself a dumb joke. And once I tell myself a dumb joke, then the floor drops out and I descend rapidly into a very deep, dark, and frightening and difficult place.
And, and if I can say that for this show in particular, rapidly was for me a key word.
Mm-hmm.
I knew nothing about this place. Lori and I are pretty close. Mm-hmm. I didn't know she'd start to write a word of it until we were up on Martha's Vineyard working on another play, which is also going to be a great play, by the way. But when suddenly I just said, you know, I just wrote this first act, and then we could just take the actors from the other show and just hear it.
And how long ago was this? When was this?
This was the August of 2017, so not that long ago.
Right. Yeah.
And I said, of course, yes. And the actors that afternoon read what is not unchanged, but very much the complete first act of White Noise. And we hit the intermission, and everybody on the table burst into tears. And the intensity of the emotional reaction was partly because of the content of the play. The play is so powerful. But partly, I think, it was a kind of aesthetic shock. Because all of us, having spent our life in this profession, recognize when you're in the presence of a completely assured voice. And the voice of this play was totally present from the first moment. Mm. And it was just, you just feel you're in good hands from the moment Leo opens his mouth. And it sounds very different from any of Susan Lloyd's other plays, but it has its...
How so?
The, I mean, if we talk in that much disputed word style.
Can I have a sip of your coffee?
It is a kind of heightened, realistic style, and you can have all of my coffee.
I'm just gonna have a sip.
It's a kind of heightened, realistic style that is much less formally ostentatious than most of our other plays. Mm-hmm. There's linguistic, there's bravura linguistic things within it, but they are essentially subsumed into realistic dialogue. It feels more like a realistic play than anything that Susan Lee's written for. And yet, it's also totally understandable. I at one point was trying to convince Susan Lloyd to call this Father Comes Home from the Wars Part 9, because to me it is the extension of Father Comes Home. But it's and that sense, and this is the thing that I see Susan Lloyd do that I know very, very few writers who can do this, is that when they tap into something and drop in, she's inside of it. She's inside of not just what the next sentence is going to be, but what the world and language of this playing character, in a way that was just really fun.
And so, Susan Lloyd, to explain, what's that like for you? What did you tap into? What did you find when you dropped into what became this play? What surprised you about
that? I feel like I was dropping into, I mean, it sounds corny, but I feel like I was dropping into the present moment. And that's what makes the play so fucking trippy. It's like now. It's now. And it's like now again. Ooh, here we are now again. It's right on the now. And it's exhilarating for that reason.
And I think it's exhilarating, and it's also a work of art, which means it's actually kind of hard to talk about.
Right.
And we found that in general with audiences, audiences are having very powerful responses.
Yeah.
They're not finding it easy to talk about their responses because the sort of what I feel about the play, certainly what the goal of the production was to take everybody and pull them into such detail of the experience of the characters that we didn't have a chance to sit back and put people into the categories that we're putting them into, that we actually just are stuck in the point of view of the characters.
And
of course, particularly, I feel like this play is written for me in the specific sense of it's written for an audience that feels that it's woke, that feels that on some level we get the history of racism in this country, and we get the problem of black-white relationships, and we've struggled with it, and we see it clearly. And the play goes, oh, you think you see it clearly? No, you don't. It's way deeper than you think. And so it shakes you up. It shakes me up on a kind of visceral level that's really...
Did it shake you up writing it, Susan Lang?
Oh, yeah. Oh, let's not...
How did you...
I mean, compared to plays like... Let's just... I mean, Father Comes Home, the Worst took a long time. Top Dog, Underdog took took no time at all relative to this play. Top Dog, Underdog was... It was like it was just poured into me in a kind of way, you know. This play, I feel like I was, you know, tunneling through solid rock, you know, or going to do a, you know, you remember those boys in that in that cave in Thailand last year or whatever?
Sure.
Remember, I mean,
yeah.
I feel like I was one of those. I was sometimes the boys in the cave and the rescuers. I was going through, and you know, through water, through rock, through darkness, through, you know, listening to the voice of these people who needed to be brought to the surface so that they could survive.
Right.
Somehow. And that's what it felt like. And it was horrifically difficult. I mean, it was horrible because it was horrible. It was awful. No, because I had to hold in my mind, in my heart, in my guts, the consciousness of four different people who the world has shoved into four opposing corners. And so I felt like actually I was being quartered. And I don't think that it wasn't comfortable.
Yeah.
But my husband kept saying, you have to keep going, Christian. He was like, you have to keep writing, you have to keep writing. And I would jump up from my desk and go, I can't do it, I can't do this, I can't do this. Just sit down, write some more, write some more. I mean, that was really the process of writing this play. It was like, oh, fuck.
And it was it about the topics that were being addressed, like the sort of, you know, all the sort of hot button issues that you're talking about, and also about the kind of pull of all the different characters, the four characters that they...
The topics are being addressed, and because they're being addressed by people who have just four different points of view, I had to... And because the way the play works, which I gotta say I'm very proud of, that we... The play loves all four characters equally.
Right.
The play roots for, cheers on all four characters equally. So when we hear Leo's solo or Leo's lines, or we watch Leo struggle, we're rooting for him. When we see Ralph struggle, we're understanding him. Even though we might not agree with him, we get where he's coming from. I understand.
Right.
I get it.
Right.
I'm vibing with you, Ralph. Every word that comes out of Ralph's mouth, I agree with.
Right.
It's just
Ralph is the character played by Thomas Sadowski for
I mean, Dawn, I get where she's coming from. Misha, I'm understanding her. And so it's presenting these subjects in a way that's including all the characters. Nobody in this play, no character in this play gets thrown under the bus.
Right.
We're all on the bus. We're all right on the bus together, sitting wherever we want. And that's really hard to maintain as a writer when you're creating that from nothing.
Yeah.
Because usually we side with one character against another.
Right.
You know, but not this play, which is why I think it's so disturbing, I think. Or so... heartbreaking, in the heartbreaking wide open, and now I can like talk about things that I couldn't talk about before.
Yeah.
You know, because I realize it's okay to have these conversations with my friends, or, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
The kind of, as we talked a little bit about the inciting event of the play, or the thing that comes out of the inciting event of the play, was a thing that when I thought early in its run and didn't know what was going to happen in this play.
Right.
And now it's a little bit out there. It's kind of a Leo, the character played by David Diggs, asks his friend to do something. How do you prefer people to come into this play? Is that do you want it to be a surprise? It's kind of out there because it's been in the reviews and things like that.
But
how did you think of, how do you describe the play to people as they, they're coming into it?
I have more of your comedy.
I actually don't know how to describe the play. It's a play about bowling, as you said. what is certainly true is that there is an innocence that the early audiences have of not knowing that it's a play that's going to be about slavery in a very real way that is compelling. But what has been exciting to me is watch that the audience response has not in any way dissipated or been watered down by the fact that a lot of audience members are walking in knowing that information now.
And people have seen it now two and three times.
We're still getting, you know, gasps from the audience. We're still getting people say, you know, fuck no,
right,
you know, at certain moments. And so, you know, like with any good drama, knowing the story isn't screwing up your appreciation of it. We all know what happens in Hamlet, but it doesn't make it a
good point.
Oedipus, right?
Yeah,
I mean, how
right.
do people watch
We all
Oedipus?
Know how that ends. That's and true.
Even
yeah.
back in the day, yeah. you know, they were like, yeah, we're going to go watch this play, yo. Yeah, and he's going to, yeah, right, spoiler alert. I mean,
right.
it didn't diminish the,
right?
So hopefully it works like that.
Can I say one other thing about bowling, Gordon?
I wish you would.
Just because this is you know, going to help characterize how geeky I am. But for me, the thing that has been with me from the moment I read this is Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, which, for those of you who haven't read it, came out about 20 years ago and is a landmark work of sociology. It is an astonishing book. And he uses the decline of bowling leagues as the image for the decline of American civic life. For the way, see, cool, right?
I hadn't even read that book. rehearsal process. You didn't tell me about.
No.
That's what I'm talking about.
I gotta keep some of this stuff close to the rest.
But the
book is totally worth rereading. I mean, he's an amazing
alone.
and And what his contention is that the breaking down of sort of the post-war American consensus in civic society can be traced by the decline of bowling leagues, the decline of unions, the decline, all of these non-political but civic organizations where people organize themselves as a community.
Right.
And to me, the bowling team that is the four characters in the show and the band, Clover, that is the four characters in the show, that coming apart is a perfect container and holder for what the play is actually about. Mm-hmm. It's about those relationships falling apart and fragmenting. So, little sociology shout out.
Yeah, I'm in line with those people. That's what I'm talking about. But what I mean is, but I appreciate that someone, you know, people have thought about this because that's what I could feel, and not having the scholarly reference, I could feel that. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Susan Lahr, you are the master writer chair here at the Public.
Or SLP.
SLP. Yeah. Yeah. What is that? What is that? What does that mean? And how does that? How? Tell me about your sort of usual interactions.
I feel like I'm but emeritus is not right because professors emeritus high.
I retired.
That means you're not.
Right, and I'm not a retiring. I'm not the retiring type.
Yeah.
I'm the hardworking type. You know. So I feel like Oscar, because it was his idea to bring me on as the master writer chair.
Right. How long ago now? That was a while
like
ago.
10 years
yeah,
it's ago.
A decade. Decade, yeah.
A decade.
Yeah.
I know, a decade ago. Yeah. And I
proof
just,
of concept, yo. I mean, seriously, can I actually
say
something about this?
Talk.
So
talk.
This is partly, I've had a long interaction throughout my career with the university system. It's my parents were academics, although I'm not an academic, I am a professor. And what became clear to me at a certain point is that what the university provided, in addition to education, were places for intellectuals to practice their craft. Mm. Martha Nussbaum sits in a chair of philosophy at the University of Chicago, not in order to teach, but because our society has decided that universities are the institutions that should support philosophers. And that's part of the University of Chicago's function, is to support a great American philosopher. Theater should do exactly the same thing with playwrights. That we needed to say, wait a minute, it's our job as nonprofit institutions to provide a place for the artists who make up our field to practice their craft. So we created the Master Writer Chair with the indispensable help of the Mellon Foundation, who haven't given us money for it for many years, but they were beautiful thought partners, Diane Ragsdale, there in starting this program. We brought Susan Lahr on, and the whole idea was, here's a Master Writer Chair. You don't have a job except to write plays. And what I think what Susan Lahr has done over the last 10 years, if you look at Father Comes Home from the Wars, if you look at Book of Grace, if you look now at White Noise, is demonstrate that the existence of that space, that chair to sit in, has made possible a glorious renaissance of her writing at a point in her career where an awful lot of American playwrights have ceased to produce anything of interest. And she's producing the greatest work, forgive me, the greatest work you've ever written, I think, in the last.
I think so. I think I'm getting better.
And that's, to me, as a materialist, that is just proof positive of the fact is that if you take a great artist and you give them the security and the space to do their work, they will reward you as a society a hundredfold. It's what we should be doing.
And so how does it fit into kind of the other things you do, Susan Lahr? Like you mentioned before we turned on the mics that you're working on a TV show also. You're in the hard part of the TV show writing part. How does your work at the Public and feed into kind of everything you do?
Yeah,
and how does it fit into your whole career?
It allows me to, I want to also mention things at the Public because something I'm also excited about here is Watch Me Work.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, and it's basically a free writing class.
And anyone can come, right?
Anyone can come, and if you can't physically be there actually in person, you can tweet us your questions, and I'll answer you in real time. And it's about, the title's called Watch Me Work, but it's about your work, your creative process, not mine. And I'm very proud. We've been doing it for 10 years, and
It's every week, basically. It seems
pretty
like
pretty much every week when we can get, because we do it on the mezz, on the mezzanine, in the lobby, basically. Yeah. And we just welcome anybody who wants to walk in off the street and get some feedback about their writing or their any kind of creative project that they're working on. I'm very excited about that because that the Master Writer Chair has given me the opportunity to create this community of people who need encouragement for their work.
How has that in turn encouraged you?
Well, and that's one of the things we're talking about, that sometimes the best thing to do when you begin to question your role in the world or what the world is doing is to be of service. And it's really important that I am of service to, my actual students at NYU or my, students, at Watch Me Work who come and go as they please.
Right, yeah.
So it's really joyful. It's a very, very joyful thing. And helpful also. I think people say they get a lot of help from the class. But but then we have, these ginormous things like writing TV shows and writing movies. And I did the
We should mention Native Sun, which just got released on HBO.
Released. Yeah. I know, it's been a big week.
Yeah.
I know, like, what's up with all that stuff? But I do think that being here allows me the freedom to be of service to the culture in all aspects. And so while maybe another writer might have to take jobs just to make sure that the food bill is paid or whatever, because I don't have to do that, I can be very mindful when I say, I would like to do Native Son. I'm not doing it to make a check.
And also from my own observation, the difference between Susan Laurie and other writers is, of course, she's going to work in film. Of course, she's going to work in television, partly because of the financial rewards and partly because they're great mediums with really interesting things to do. But because she's got the chair, it means that no matter what else she does, she's got a home in the theater. And that stays a serious part of her life. Not just something like, oh, yeah, I can't wait to get back to the theater, but the next 5 or 7 or 15 years are going to be filled up with these TV projects. But maybe when there's a gap, it's just like she can go do whatever she wants in film or television. And her home is right here. The chair is sitting here. And that's to me the ideal of a sort of balanced life that we should be providing for more artists.
For me, theater is where I get to do my deepest digging, my most thorough and thoughtful and difficult explorations of the human condition. Because, it's presented in real time, live people talking to the living, it's like nothing else. So you can't beat it for that. And then, when you do a TV show or a film, you reach maybe more people, more easily, and that's cool. Right. But, there's nothing like the living.
What's on your plate next, Oscar? What are you up to? The rest of this season and next season and then the summer season after
and
then
the season after.
There's a lot of things going on. None of them more important than White Noise, which has been just a seminal moment in my artistic life, honestly. I have loved this process. And the fact that Susan Laurie and I have been close friends for 30 years and that we get to do this, we teach together. We
do.
It's just such an affirmation of a life in the theater. This is what you hope for. You hope for a life where you create relationships that actually extend over the course of your lifetime and that mean something.
Does this play have a life after?
There's no question it has a life. We don't know what that life is going to look like, but we hope it'll grow up and get a job. Right now the overarching task, I'm nearing one can see the finish line of my career, in the immediate, but a few years down the road. The big job that I have now is to try to make sure that the gains that we have made at the Public Theater over the last 15 years are permanent, that what the Public Theater stands for, not just that it will institutionally survive in perpetuity or as long as the climate allows us to survive, but that also the things that it stands for, the example that it sets, the model it sets for other than the influence that we can have over the culture is permanent and firmly embedded. And that's, in order to achieve that, you sort of have to work on a lot of different fronts. You have to make art that matters to people. Mm-hmm. You have to make art that reaches people that don't normally get reached by that art. You have to give people the chance to make art who aren't given the chance to make that art. You have to build an institution, including a board of directors, that understands what it stands for. You have to have the buildings, the places, the palaces for the people to contain that. You got to get the money in the bank, the reserves and the endowment
right.
that allow
it. Which is why you're
wearing that
suit.
You have to do a lot of different things.
Is that why
I'm wearing
that
the suit
really
today.
Nice.
Yep. No, you know what? I woke up and I said, I'm going to be on the radio. I'm going to put on a suit.
That's exactly right.
He looks good today. You're wearing that three-piece suit. Yeah.
But it's that's the really exciting thing for me right now on a macro level. You know, when I have to get out of the rehearsal room and do something else, it's trying to make sure that that this institution and what it stands for is a permanent part of the American landscape. Mm. Mm. Mm.
Yeah. And Susan Laurie, what's next for you?
Working.
Yeah, you
know,
you're working.
What I'm doing. Some more words.
Can you tell us about the TV show?
Some more. It's Aretha. They're doing Nat Geo is doing the, and Imagine, Brian Grazer and Ron Howard's company. They're teaming up and doing the next installment of the Genius series, and they did. It started with Einstein and then Picasso, and now they're doing Aretha Franklin. Yeah. And you know, I'm just honored to be asked to help tell her story.
And they are so lucky to have you.
Yeah, and just it's just a joy, and what a great force she is. Yeah.
Do you work on multiple plays at once? It sounds like, because Oscar was telling about a play. What's coming next then?
Which one's coming? It's like if you're in a room and you have many turntables.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like on different levels, you know, like a turntable near the ceiling and a turntable on the floor, and every table has a turntable. Yeah. So on each turntable, and you, Oscar, you work like this too, and we all do. You got a different piece of vinyl spinning on each turntable, and that's kind of, so today it's... You work on that one, and then bing, 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 you get that going, and you kind of get that going. So you're doing, so you're a DJ kind of,
And let's just say then you know that puts me in the suit with the pencil and the calendar, trying to figure out when is Susan Laurie going to be enough done with Aretha that we can start rehearsals for the next show. Because the next show is going to be fantastic.
I know.
And we got the show.
Right,
we got the show. We just got to get it into a calendar now.
I know.
Can you tell us anything about that show and what it's about, or no?
No.
Oh, okay.
But
that was my guess.
But maybe you'll come back again.
I'm sure we will. Yeah, exactly.
Because this is so much fun. You know, it's best. I feel my work is best developed with some level of privacy.
Yep.
You know, you get like the pot, the water boils best with the lid on it.
Yep.
And that's really my work. Yeah.
Well, we can't wait to see it when it's ready. Thank you both. Thanks for doing this. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you,
Gordon.
So much,
fun.
Gordon.
Fun.
Thank you.
That was Susan Laurie Parks and Oscar Eustace, the writer and director of the new play White Noise, now playing at the Public Theater. If you like what you've heard on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes and subscribe wherever finer podcasts are dispensed. Next week, I'll be talking to Kelly O'Hara, the Tony-winning Broadway favorite who's now back on Broadway in Kiss Me, Kate. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Suffs. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Suffs celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here,
but
not there.
No.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.